I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, in this installment of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks, the press and public trust. Since he announced his candidacy for president in 2015, Donald Trump has pounded a steady drumbeat of claims that major news outlets create fake news. A recent poll indicated that 61% of Democrats and 89% of Republicans agree with him. And Mr. Trump and other political leaders have taken those claims one step further, asserting that the press is the enemy of the people. Is there a link between that rhetoric and the kind of violence inflicted on the newsroom of the Capital Gazette last week? We'll talk to a photographer for the Gazette and the advocacy director for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Midday Culture Connections starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. Sherry, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too.
So one question that we want to ask today, because we're going to talk about the public assessment and credibility with the press. I mean, how effective do you think President Trump's efforts to undermine the credibility of the press have been? And do you think he's been convincing to lots of people that the press is, you know, fake news, the enemy of the people, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, he didn't start it, but he's very good at spotting trends and then riding them and exaggerating them. And that's what's happened now. And certainly his core base feels that the media are quote, making it up. But I think a larger population are suspicious, and he certainly whipped up the animosity that was already building around our lack of trust, building around the media, and made it worse. Yeah, he's a factor.
Here he is speaking to the CPAC conference in Washington, D.C., February of 2017.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake. A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people. Because they have no sources. They just make them up when there are none.
We have plenty of sources. We don't make them up, by the way. That's President Trump speaking to the CPAC conference. Obviously, this is red meat for the folks at that particular gathering. According to reports, the murderer who burst into the Gazette newsroom last week and began killing people indiscriminately appears to have held a particular grudge against this particular paper for its coverage of his harassment of a former high school classmate. But his social media accounts do contain references that indicate his anger at the media was more broad. The investigation is, of course, ongoing, and more revelations about the killer's motives may emerge. Social media accounts of the killer reference, for example, the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris and his displeasure at the Gazette's criticism of President Trump. Joining us now on the line from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. is Dr. Courtney Raj. She's the advocacy director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Dr. Raj, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So your research and the work that you do at the Committee to Protect Journalists shows that it's often local journalists like the folks in that newsroom, the 11 people in that newsroom last Thursday in Annapolis, they are often the targets of this kind of violence.
Sadly, that's true. We know that the vast majority of journalists who are targeted for their work are local journalists working in their communities. And nearly all of the journalists that we've recorded who have been murdered have been murdered with full or partial impunity, and the vast majority of them were local journalists.
Do you make sense of that in any way, Sherry Parks? I mean, does it strike you, does it shock you to find that it's local journalists?
No. I mean, one, that's who you can get to if that's what you want to do, and that's who you may have, at least in your mind, an ongoing relationship. I think there really has not been much discussion in the U.S. yet. I mean, Courtney's organization only started tracking this in the U.S. a year ago, because we used to think that this was something that happened somewhere else. But I think the untold story is that journalists often have people who are going after them verbally online, stalking them, and people often don't understand the brave work of just, you know, being you.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just clarify something?
Sure.
We have been recording at the Committee to Protect Journalists, journalists killed and imprisoned around the world in every single country since 1992, including the United States. And there have been 7 journalists who have been killed in their relation to their work in the U.S. since we began keeping records in 1992. But you're right that last year, what we started to do, along with a coalition of more than 20 other organizations, is to track press freedom threats more broadly so that we're not just trying to track the deadly violence, but also the impact of anti-press rhetoric, attacks on the press, arrests, etc.
And thanks for that. I was quoting an article in The Atlantic, but thank you for that clarification.
Yeah. Sure. And Courtney, you know, I actually brought this up with Joel Simon, your colleague at the committee, last week, the day after the tragedy in Annapolis. A friend who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for, he's now working for ProPublica, Alec McGillis, made a point that, not in relation to this event, but many months prior to it, we were at an event that he said, you know, it's the lack of, because local journalism has shrunk so much, because there are fewer people in newsrooms like the Baltimore Sun or the Capital Gazette. What happens then is that people in the communities don't know a journalist the way they used to. They're not, their kids aren't playing on the same little league team. They're not going to the same shul. They're not hanging out at the same swimming pools in the summer. And because of that, because so many people no longer actually know a neighbor or someone in their circle who is a journalist, that contributes to the general distrust and mistrust of the media writ large. What do you think about that?
I'm not 100% sure I agree. I think that what we've heard anecdotally is that, in general, people have negative attitudes towards the media, particularly national elite media. But when they actually talk about their local news organizations, their, you know, local radio station or TV station or newspaper, that people have a different attitude. And I think that what we heard when we did the first ever press freedom mission to the United States is that local journalists are covering a much greater swath of the community than they did before. So it is certainly possible that they have, you know, fewer opportunities to develop those in-depth relationships. But I think that we still need to have more research on local attitudes.
And there's no doubt, given the research that you and the folks at the Committee to Protect Journalists have been doing, that there is, in fact, an uptick in animus towards journalists. I mean, trolling, for example, online and through other methods. Trolling is definitely on the rise, according to the work that you've done. Is that right?
Trolling has become one of the favorite ways of attacking journalists, and we see this around the world. And I think that as the internet becomes increasingly central to how people get their news and interact with information, that it's not surprising to see trolling on the rise. And we've tracked that all around the world, and it can have real severe consequences, because not only can it lead to specific threats against individual journalists and media organizations, but it also creates this really negative environment in which the press are operating.
And what is the antidote to that? What do journalists have in terms of arrows in their quiver to counter that? Is there a particular way that you and others would recommend journalists handle that sort of thing?
It does vary on context. And part of certainly all journalists should make sure that they understand the very basics of digital security and how to keep track of their social profiles, know what is about them online, make sure that they're using dual-factor authentication to reduce the likelihood of hacking, ensure that they're auditing their social media accounts to understand what sort of personal information is out there and available to them. One of the recommendations that our emergencies response team gives on this is to have separate profiles for your personal and your professional life. That can help reduce the transition from an online trolling into a kind of real world physical threat.
And Sherry, do you have the impression that trolling in journalism is worse or the same or, you know, higher or lower than trolling in academia, for example, where you've had your career, or trolling in the corporate world, or trolling? I mean, does it seem that journalists are in fact being singled out in a way that people in other professions are not?
Well, I mean, we can go beyond impressions. There's a fair amount of evidence now gathered by scholars that particularly women online, there's a long history of women being trolled if they're in the media. And if they're journalists, certainly academics get trolled when they are in the media. And so the relationship between mediation and trolling is pretty high, particularly for women heretofore, but now it's equal opportunity.
We found that as well, if I can just jump in.
Sure.
With women journalists resoundingly reporting that they regularly face trolling now as a regular part of their jobs. And when you are a woman journalist and or a minority journalist, an LGBTQI journalist, any sort of, holding multiple identities publicly, that leads to a lot of trolling, and there's been a lot of evidence of that. And we've also recorded, more than 1,000 tweets from President Trump attacking the press, denigrating them as fake news, et cetera. And we see that this has a ripple effect, not only on journalists here in the United States, but on the media around the world.
Yeah, because then those tweets get retweeted and highlighted in other forums, Instagram, Facebook. There's an impression, I think, that some might have, certainly people on the left might have, that this trolling is limited in large measure to people on the right, the alt-right. But I don't think that's necessarily the case at all. Not necessarily that it's an equivalent thing. There may be considerably more of it on the right. But I've certainly talked to at least one journalist on the left who has been trolled by people on the left. What's your impression of that, Courtney?
We don't really look at the partisan aspect of the trolling, because we see that it is experienced by journalists across the board. And I think that in many, for example, in the Philippines, where Maria Ressa, who is an award-winning journalist who has an independent outlet called The Rappler, she has been targeted by the government of Duterte. So, I don't think that we can also easily categorize journalists or politicians into right and left. It depends on the context. And we know, especially from women journalists, that across the board, they face trolling.
There's an ongoing conversation right now among the left about whether they should be as uncivil as the right traditionally has been. And there certainly is a part of the left that says, well, that they have to use the same fire. And I think that not only includes toward people on the right, but media as well.
Yeah, I mean, this instance with Maxine Waters, a congresswoman from California, telling people, if you see public officials from the Trump cabinet or the Trump administration in restaurants, go ahead and heckle them the way that, Sarah Sanders was asked to leave a restaurant in Virginia. Kirstjen Nielsen, the head of Homeland Security, heckled it at a restaurant in D.C. I'm thinking of a conversation I had with Amy Chozick, who was a reporter for the New York Times during the Clinton, during both of the last couple of presidential campaigns, and then during the Clinton campaign in the primaries against Bernie Sanders. She was trolled in the most obscene and vulgar ways by people who were supporting Senator Sanders. I mean, and she has myriad examples of those in her book. I mean, this, and it was scary. I mean, I can imagine, how she felt at that time. Courtney, when it comes to people on the alt-right, and again, I'm not making an equivalence here, but you have these characters like Milo Yiannopoulos, who was singled out as having advocating for journalists to be attacked by vigilantes. That meme, as it were, became quite apparent within hours of the attack in Annapolis. Is the alt-right making a concerted effort to join in with President Trump? Are they, is Trump, throwing gasoline on the fire that they've already started?
think it's hard for us to look at the motivations of the alt-right, but if we look at what has been happening with journalists who are covering the alt-right, my colleague did a report on this in March, looking at the threats that journalists covering the alt-right are facing. So we do know that they're having a lot of experiences that are, you know, threatening, that are making them feel uncomfortable, that they're getting trolled and that harassed online, and that this is becoming part of the job of covering that issue. We've also, however, seen, for example, that President Trump and Vice President Pence came out after the shootings in Annapolis and, you know, basically said that they're sorry to hear what happened, that no journalists deserve to be killed for their work. And I think that's a really important message that I hope would get amplified, because, you know, when we talk about Milo's tweet, this, who is this guy? You know, we're just amplifying his hate and his rhetoric. And instead, I think we need to focus on the fact that, you know, these people were killed simply for doing their job, and that, frankly, that happens far too often. And the fact that the United States is now the third most deadly country for journalists in the world in 2018, right after Afghanistan and Syria, that should be unacceptable to us.
Yeah, in 2018, and we achieved that high ranking after the killings in Annapolis. We have an email from Jaron who says, how is academia preparing young people to know the difference between actual news and fake news? For example, training students to understand the difference between highly produced YouTube videos and video that media produced by trained journalists and actually published on websites. At MICA, where the institution where you are, Sherry Parks, are there any classes that deal with this? Any efforts to sort of get people to be media literate, as it were?
Well, I mean, I think that is part of a higher education. I mean, 20 years ago, I wasn't at MICA. I taught a class where students were, they had to look at the same topic in print media, online, and in the academic literature and look at issues of credibility. And those kinds of classes are popping up more and more now as other disciplines have begun to realize that this is part of being educated. But that's education is a evidence-based, as education should be, is now itself a troll word. And so it gets looped into that. But you're right that is an essential skill for carrying responsibly any type of power, is to know the difference and how that information comes to be made.
And Courtney Ratch, there are some polls that suggest that there are very, very big barriers for legacy news outlets in particular to get over when it comes to public trust. That many people in America say the media is key to democracy, but they can't name an objective news source. So what does the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, or CBS News, what do they need to do to convince those people? I mean, Sherry's talking about evidence-based. What's your take on the fact that so many people say it's all biased?
That's a complicated question. I mean, I think there are many things that need to be done. But one Pew Research survey that they did showed that most people are getting their news online, and that of the people who are getting their news online, most of them can't actually name the outlet from where their news came. So they might say, oh, I got my news on Facebook or on Twitter. But that's kind of saying, like, I got my news on a piece of paper. And I think that this issue of sourcing, of being able to evaluate the source, understanding how the journalistic process works, I think that this, I've heard from several people who have done surveys in the U.S. and been speaking to people that, for example, the average person might not know that when someone cites an anonymous source, that source is not anonymous to the reporter. It is anonymous
or to the editor,
public,
right?
Or the editor, right? So there are all these safeguards in place to make sure that things are accurate, that nothing gets into the news outlets without having gone through appropriate verification. And I think that opening up the news process, which you've seen a lot of news organizations engage in, should help. But this idea of fake news, which has become a catch-all term for everything from misinformation, disinformation campaigns, computational propaganda, and then news that people don't like, is really problematic because it gets away from being able to talk about something specifically. Are we talking about views you don't agree with, or are we talking about concerted disinformation campaigns, you know, led by a foreign country? Those are two very different things, but we're using the same term to describe them.
And that trend of using social media, online media, almost exclusively means that people only see the news they like. They don't leaf through the newspaper and by accident see something that they might disagree with. That happens less and less.
And a part of it is people's assumption that the news is biased. Gallup has a poll from just a few days ago. 62% of Americans believe that, Americans believe that 62% of what they see in the press, whatever that means to them, is biased. I mean, Courtney, do you think that's also a product of people, for example, not understanding the way newspapers work, to take them as an example, where there is the editorial side and then there's the reporting side? And those two sides don't, you know, they don't work in tandem.
Certainly, in many conversations I've had, this issue comes up about the difficulty, of objectivity and not understanding the different roles that various, you know, editorial versus the news side play. But I also think that it's related to this broader denigration of the media, of journalism and its importance to democracy. And why journalism, it's not just about the individuals and the individual journalists. It's about the role that journalism plays in a democracy in ensuring that the public is educated and able to be an educated citizenry and know what's happening, keeping our elected leaders accountable, shining the light on those who are in power, whether we're talking about in politics, economics, or otherwise. So I think sometimes there's been a lot of navel-gazing by the media versus just focusing, you know, on the importance of their role in this broader context of a democratic system.
Yeah, Courtney, I know we got to let you go, but this did not start with Donald Trump. Your organization has documented, for example, during the Obama administration, a record number of sources were jailed during the Obama administration. I mean, they were concerned with leaks, and they were concerned with a lot of the processes that were going on in the regular media. So it didn't start with Trump. It's probably not going to end with Trump. But what do you see the next? Is there the next stage of this now that we've had this horrible tragedy in Annapolis? And how does that change the conversation, if it does?
Well, I think we have to be really concerned about precedents, because what we saw under the Obama administration was the use of the Espionage Act more than all other administrations combined. And then we've seen the Trump administration say similarly that they're going to have a war and crack down on leakers. So it's precedents that get started. So now we have this precedence of really vitriolic language against the press. We have this constant attacking of individual journalists and media outlets by those in power. And this creates a dangerous precedent. So I think we have to worry about, you know, whether we can get back to norms of civility. But who knows? Because that's not only a problem from elected leaders, as we discussed earlier with trolling. It's a problem everyone faces online.
Dr. Courtney Radge is the advocacy director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. She's also the author of the book Cyber Activism and Citizen Journalism in Egypt, Digital Dissidents and Political Change. Courtney Radge, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Parks is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art and the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. She will join me when we come back from a break. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet at Midday WIPR. By the way, before we take a break, a shout out to our colleagues at WNYC in New York and at WBUR in Boston. Last Friday, each of those newsrooms sent our newsroom lunch here at WIPR, knowing how busy our news department was covering the shooting in Annapolis. We are all very grateful to these public radio compatriots for this very delicious and gracious gesture, and we are proud of our WIPR news department for the great job they did covering this horrible event for us and for NPR listeners around the country. And this, according to the National Press Club, on Thursday, July 5th, that's the day after tomorrow, newsrooms nationwide are being asked to observe a moment of silence at 2:33 p.m. Coming up, a conversation with a journalist who works at the Capital Gazette, photojournalist Joshua McCarro joins us. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our 4th of July edition of Midday, The Science of Popularity. Derek Thompson is an editor at The Atlantic magazine, and his latest book is called Hitmakers, and he writes about why some things become popular and other things just don't. So if you are joining us today, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. Our topic is the press and public trust. You are welcome to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org, to send us a tweet, @MiddayWIPR, to follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWIPR. Right now, we are joined on the line by Capital Gazette photojournalist Josh McCarro. He was out on assignment last Thursday afternoon when the gunman entered the building, but quickly doubled back towards the Gazette when he received a phone call from his editor alerting him that something terrible had happened in their newsroom. Josh McCarro, welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So first off, our sincere condolences to you for the loss of your friends and colleagues. How are you doing, and how would you characterize the rest of the folks in the newsroom? How's everybody doing so far?
Well, first off, thank you very much. I think we're doing okay, as can be expected. We're all kind of taking it a little slow. Some of us, you know, have been working nonstop. Some of us kind of check in and do a little bit of story, a little bit of photographing, and then check out a little again. We're all trying to be here for each other, and it's never felt better to sit in a newsroom than it does today.
You took the picture, I guess, of the two guys standing in the bed of the truck. Sherry?
Well, Joshua is one of the guys standing.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're in the picture. I'm sorry. So you didn't take that photograph. Okay. So it's you and another reporter. Forgive me.
It's confusing for me, too.
Yeah. and this is putting out the paper that you all published in a miraculous and amazing way the day after this shooting. That picture has gone viral. It's been published all over the world. Tell us about that situation, that afternoon, and getting the paper out that the next morning. I know that it arrived in my inbox at 12:48 a.m. on Friday morning. Yeah.
It was I'd like you said earlier, I had an early assignment, and so I'd finished for the day. When I got the call from my editor, I was about 20 minutes outside of Annapolis, but he'd heard that there'd been a shooting. So the first thing I did is I tweeted out, "I'm okay, I'm safe, you know, I wasn't there, I'm on my way," and then I turned around and went back to Annapolis and just started photographing the scene. I hooked up with two other Capitol journalists, the only ones that I could find, Chase Cook and Pat Ferguson. I don't think we ever had a conscious moment where we decided, you know, what do we do now? I think we all three just locked in into covering the story. It was very difficult, of course, because, you know, you're looking across the street at, you know, at where you've spent so much time, and you're seeing the police dogs and the armored vehicles and, you know, the tactical police. I think the three of us just instinctually put our heads down and dove into it. It really was reflex. And, you know, the first thing we wanted to do was report on who was safe, you know, to let their loved ones know, you know, that you know, who was okay. So we were saying, oh, did you hear about Paul? You know, what about Pat? What about Celine, et cetera? And we would, you know, kind of confirm that amongst ourselves. And, you know, I think me and Chase, like, said the list back and forth to each other two or three times before we decided to tweet it. But there was just no question of what we were going to do. We kept covering, you know, we tweeted out information on who we knew it was safe. We covered the press conferences. We transmitted photos back to Baltimore, to the Baltimore Sun, where the production was being done. I also want to say eventually, and actually pretty quite soon, a number of staff from the Baltimore Sun arrived to help us cover the story. And so that was a great relief, too, because, you know, we were the three of us were all in shock. But so it was good to have our colleagues from Baltimore there. But we really locked in, you know, and then we got into the back of the truck. You know, I had my laptop. Chase was on his phone, and we had a clear view of the scene. And we just did our jobs.
Hi, Josh. This is Sherry. How are you?
Hey, Sherry.
First, I need to note to the audience that Josh and my family and his family have been friends for quite a long time. And I was one of the people that was looking for that tweet, you know, kind of running around trying to find out if he's okay. And I'm really glad that you are. The photograph that WYPR ran a few minutes ago with my picture was actually shot by Joshua. So the one that everybody likes. So thanks for that, too.
I'm delighted you're still using it.
Yeah, I am. I want to dig a minute into what you called a reflex, because I think it really is important that people understand what journalists do and how they get to do their work while we're talking about the perception of bias and objectivity. Where do you think that reflex comes from in you? Because, I mean, did 19-year-old Josh, would he have behaved the same? Or is there something about the socialization of a journalist that's in, well, I won't tell you what my opinion is, but what do you think leads to that I'm going to do this work no matter what comes from?
I believe there's a lot of conditioning. I had a lot of mentors over the years, you know, first off, you know, it's probably no accident that you end up working in a newsroom in the first place. I mean, it kind of takes a certain type to end up there. It's kind of a blend of, like, just insatiable curiosity and also, you know, being a bit introverted and a little weird. So you get into a newsroom with that personality, but then it's conditioning. You know, I started my career at the Aegis newspaper up in Harford County in the year 2000, actually. And, you know, the people there taught me just everything that I know, that reflex of, like, you know, how to respond to a call, how to talk to a police officer, how to talk to a mourning family member. Things like that. And it's just years and years of covering stories and being trusted to cover stories, being trusted by your editors, but more importantly, being trusted by your community to cover their stories.
And the outpouring of support from the community for mm-hmm. the Capital Gazette has been really extraordinary. What do you make of that? Did that surprise you in any way?
It did. It does. It's surreal. You know, you're a local newspaper, and so, you know, you make a lot of people happy, but, you know, you're a pain in the ass to a lot of people, too. And rightfully so. You know, the Capital is a pretty fairly middle-of-the-road newspaper. We don't have a particular political bent, or we try very hard not to. And so, you know, you'll show up in an assignment, and, you know, someone will say under their breath, oh, you know, the crab wrapper's here, or worse things. They call us worse things. And you just shrug it off, like, whatever, you know, that's not going to stop me. So when, you know, the response of the city and the nation has been it's just overwhelming. I mean, because you know, when you're a journalist, sometimes your head is in the game, and you're just, your head down, and you're just looking at the next deadline, the next paper. And I've noted this before to people, you almost tend to forget that people actually read what you do. People actually look at what you do. I went to the back to the building Sunday, and just to see the steady stream of people just stopping by and dropping off flowers and signing condolences. I didn't know. I love my town and I love my community. But I didn't know how good they were. I didn't know how deep their decency went.
Yeah, they love you back.
So how does, it may be too early, but do you know how this might change how you work as a photojournalist in that town next week?
It's going to be awkward. I did my first, I've taken some pictures since then, but I did my first kind of back to routine story this morning. I went and photographed a story for just a typical restaurant review. My colleague Wendy Winters, who we lost, had scheduled it for today. And I just showed up, and they were looking at me. I can't believe you're here. And I was like, no, we're here. We're not going anywhere. We're just going to keep going. So that was it. It's a little odd that they recognized me and wanted to talk. You know, they wanted to talk about the tragedy. And we kind of had to console each other for a minute. So that's odd because, you know, you're the journalist and a photojournalist in particular. You know, we don't want to, the last thing you want to do is become part of what's happening. And so that's going to be a new reality for a little while that I expect we're just going to have to help the town through. Yeah, it's going to be a learning experience for everybody.
Yeah, indeed. Have they given you access to the kind of help you all will clearly need, as anyone would, having been part of this tragedy? There were 11 people in that newsroom on Thursday. 5 of them were killed. But this is a traumatizing event for everybody who works at the Capital Gazette. What sorts of things are they making available to you to help? And do you think that that's going to be in fact helpful?
I'm sure it is going to be helpful. And you know, the company's been real good. They're trauma counselors on hand, and I feel comfortable in that. And also, you know, the Anne Arundel County Emergency Services has been there since, I mean, they were checking in on us Thursday night as we were reporting. They were kind of checking in and worried about us. People I'd photographed for years, police officials I'd photographed for years, were suddenly, hey, here's some water, you know, remember to eat, take deep breaths, that kind of stuff. So it's going to be a hard road. Everybody's reacting to it kind of differently. Everybody's kind of trading their triggers back and forth. We're trying to make loud noises in the newsroom and stuff like that. And if I could take a second, I just kind of want to also share out that, like, it's very personal for us at the Capital newspaper, but this is really personal for a lot of people, and to journalists everywhere. I mean, I've talked to journalists, you know, from all over the country who have been hurt by this. And I'd like to say that, you know, they should acknowledge that they're hurt and get help for that too. I mean, it was an attack on all of us. It was an attack on every single one of us. And I know if this had been, you know, when we lost those TV reporters a couple of years ago, I know, you know, I felt it deep in my heart. And I know everyone else is feeling it that way now too.
Sure. Linnell and I, my wife and I, were at Rob Hyacin's memorial service last night at the Irvine Nature Center here in Baltimore. More than 500 people came, many of them in the journalism profession, as well as, you know, friends and people who had connections to the Hyacin family. The level of grief and shock and outrage is really quite remarkable. Well, Josh McCarro, thank you very much. We all wish you the best. We're going to let you get back to work. And we very much appreciate your taking the time to share your perspective. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Sherry. Take care, everybody.
You too.
And you take care as well. Josh McCarroll, he's a photojournalist with the Capital Gazette newspaper. He's joined us from the Gazette's temporary newsroom in College Park. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's a senior vice president at MICA and the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. We'll get to your calls and comments when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I hate the press. I hate you especially. But the fact is, we need you. We need a free press. If you want to preserve democracy as we know it, you have to have a free and many times adversarial press. And without it, I'm afraid that we would lose so much of our individual liberties over time. That's how dictators get started.
Senator John McCain responding to President Trump's remarks at the CPAC conference in February of 2017. He was speaking at that time to CNN. If you're just joining us, I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives now at the Maryland Institute College of Art. As we mentioned earlier in the program, in 2018, with the four journalists who were killed in Annapolis last week, the United States became the third most deadly country for journalists in the world, behind Afghanistan, who's had 10 journalists killed, and Syria, who've had 6 journalists killed. Our phone number, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. Let's go to the phones. Dale in Greenmount, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks. Hi, Dale. You with me?
Yeah, this is Dale. I'm back.
Hi. So what's on your mind today?
Yeah, my biggest concern about the news industry on the left and right is that most of the stories I hear are repeated on both stations, and that even on NPR, Yale Marcus yourself is not having a biased opinion. And I know both sides do, but you do, and that the reporting is not as thorough as it should be as far as fact-checking. Now, here's a quick example. In September, y'all did reports, all the stories did reports about this man named Garcia in Chicago that was being deported because he was just a little bit older than most of the people that qualify for DACA. There was a age cutoff. And that same month, a Chicago commercial bakery got raided. 800 of its 300 employees were found to be undocumented. You never heard anything about it. Back in October, $95 million from one company paid fines for violating unlawful employment of undocumented. So both sides are just as guilty on their stance on certain subjects.
Okay, Dale. Well, I appreciate the comment. I think we have the gist. It's interesting. You know, people often say to me, you know, such and such a thing happened, and you never heard anything about it. Of course, it could be that they just didn't hear anything about it. Perhaps, you know, certain people intersect with certain stories at certain times. But this is that Dale is probably professing a point of view that a lot of people hold.
Well, and there's actually something there. And, you know, this is, in my heart doesn't want to say that the media helped make this situation. But in a way, the marketing of the media did. I mean, you'll remember it. I mean, some of it's linked to what you said earlier, in that there are fewer and fewer outlets covering the world. And so, of course, things have to be selected to go in, and some things never get covered. But do you remember when TV news said, "We bring you the world," if anything that's fit to print, the New York Times? So that part of the marketing of the media has suggested that they bring you everything. And even the concept of objectivity is actually complete objectivity. I mean, Dale has a point there, is impossible. Do I believe that most professional journalists, as Joshua described, it's baked in their bones and it's the Holy Grail and they strain toward it with all of their might? Yes, I do. But every human being is biased, and there has been a blurring recently in journalism, as you pointed out, between the editorial side and the news side. So now routinely mainstream journalists are saying their opinion almost as if they can't stop themselves anymore. So that idea of complete objectivity has been unraveled in a way that I think leads to some investigation that we need to look at that.
What's the distinction between credibility and believability?
Okay, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up. They seem at first glance to be the same thing.
Yeah, they do.
So credibility is, do you believe that, you know, this is professional journalism? That believability is, do you personally believe them? Let me give you an example. Actually, about 10 years ago, a group of graduate students and I did a white paper for an NGO, for a nonprofit organization. And they wanted to look at the difference between CNN and cable news around a particular topic. And the target market was young adults. So we asked young adults, and they said, oh, no, we understand that professional news is highly credible, but we believe the one that seems more like us. And I think that's really the point, that and increasingly, to the extent that audiences look at news, they look at news that is part of their closely lived lives. And so they don't get the professional, credible journalism nearly as much.
Let's go to Frank in Annapolis. Frank, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Good afternoon, Dr. Parks. And thank you for taking this call. I'm sorry to depart the gravitas of the subject at hand, DACA, but I must say that I'm calling from Annapolis, and I want to salute Joshua and the entire staff at the Capitol for not only the professionalism they've shown post the shooting, but really before the shooting. They've shown great character under great stress, and I've known them over the years. I've known all the editors and the last three editors of the paper, and I can tell you it's not easy to cover the nation's capital, but more importantly, the state capital and the city, all at the same time in a small regional daily newspaper. But more important, this staff has shown character that shocked us all, because we could not speak. We were speechless in Annapolis when this happened. We're not accustomed to this. But the Capitol staff spoke, and they spoke most eloquently. So we're very proud of the staff. And I can tell you that a lot of people in Annapolis know that there's disdain. We want to be known as Annapolis, not as where it happened. I think it will pass, but we've lost a number of columnists and a number of writers and even an advertising staffer. That has been a great loss to our community.
Well, thank you for that call, Frank. And I think you know, Frank is expressing a sentiment that, you know, many people in Annapolis and around the world are feeling. The fact that it was journalism, the fact that it was a paper that, you know, as Courtney Radge indicated and others, Josh indicated, it's a middle-of-the-road paper. It's not like, this isn't Breitbart News or, you know, some lefty journal. This is something that's a small staff doing their best, as Frank mentions, trying to cover the state government, mm-hmm. the city government, and their proximity to Washington, D.C. has them covering some national stories.
And I'm glad you both brought that up, because the national media has characterized the Capitol as a community paper when it's actually more than that, because it is in the state capital.
Yeah, but it's in a town that's a pretty small town, you know, comparatively. Let's see if we can get one more call. Clarence in New Freedom, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to make this short. First and foremost, to all of the reporters and photographers and everything in this country, we have the greatest. Right now, we have an administration worse than the former, and tonight we'll see if Mr. Trump meant what he said, but prayers and kudos to the staff of that paper down there in Annapolis.
And Clarence, we are out of time. Thank you so much for your call. Clarence is going to have the last word. Dr. Sherry Parks, always good to see you, and we shall see you the next time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Parks joins us on the first Tuesday of the month for Midday Culture Connections. She's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Her book is called Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong black woman. We'd like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation with Derek Thompson. In his best-selling book called Hitmakers, Thompson examines the science of popularity, why some things and some people become popular while others do not. That's coming up tomorrow on the 4th of July edition of Midday. We want to have you stay tuned at the top of the hour today for Out of the Blocks with Aaron Henkin. That's on tap right after the news from NPR. I'm Tom Hall. On behalf of the entire Midday team, happy 4th of July. Have a great Independence Day holiday. Thanks for listening.